judge that this is getting recorded audio, so he knows that. And two, you may want to announce, because I do see people from the community, so that they can ask for Q&A session in Spanish.
Le truc le plus pratique pour écrire, hein, il faut mettre le document. Et ici, ce que vous pouvez faire, c'est oui. Si vous dessinez, que vous pouvez le mettre là.
Ah, parfait.
Oui. Ou alors, vous pouvez vous pencher. Là.
Oui.
On va voir si ça se réchauffe.
D'accord. Et sinon, finalement, je fais.
Mais c'est parce qu'il n'y a pas de. C'est la seule pièce, oui. C'est la seule salle de classe où il n'y a pas de tableau. Alors, des fois, il y a un tableau amovible, mais.
Non, mais
enfin, en haut là-bas, c'est un petit peu compliqué.
Non, mais je m'adapte.
Ouais. Tout à coup. Non, je donc, est-ce que vous voulez qu'on oublie ça
ou... Oui, on oublie
on
ça.
On oublie ça.
Oui. Alors, c'est bien si je parle 5 minutes pour
expliquer.
Et après, c'est le conversation.
Je vais vous présenter.
Oui, c'est, et après, c'est le concert.
Et après, on discute
converse.
Un peu, puis après, ça, on
parfait.
Du monde.
Et ça dure à peu près.
Ça dure 90 minutes, donc jusqu'à 2h30.
Okay.
Et Nadine me demandait de vous préciser que la séance était enregistrée. Juste pour que vous sachiez que tout ce que vous direz sera revenu contre vous. Donc,
señoras y señores, damas y caballeros, mesdames et messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Faculty of Law and the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism. My name is René Provost, for those of you who don't know me, and I'm a professor in the Faculty of Law. And it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Judge Juan Guzmán Tapia. Who is going to share with us today his experiences in trying to bring some justice to Chile after the dictatorship in that country. Judge Guzman was born in El Salvador, I learned, but is a Chilean by birth as well, and lived in a significant number of countries growing up following his father in his diplomatic appointments, and so has a multicultural background prior to studying law at the University of Chile and doing postgraduate work at the University of, or in Paris. He will first talk to us a little bit about the context in Chile where he was called upon to perform his duties as a judge. Then there will be a phase of the presentation where we'll have a conversation about some of the themes that this gives rise to finally open up the conversation to people who want to intervene. I would ask at that point, if you want to ask questions, to use the microphones because the session is being recorded today. Pour la phase de questions, si vous souhaitez poser vos questions en français, comme je l'ai mentionné, le juge Guzman a étudié à Paris et donc parle un excellent français. Et claro que también si quieren preguntar el castellano, podemos hablar castellano también. Donc je cède la parole avec grand plaisir au juge Guzmán.
Merci beaucoup René, c'est un grand honneur d'être avec vous et vous aussi. Et vraiment, j'ai voulu connaître cette ville, ce pays, il y a très longtemps. Je rêvais, quand j'étais petit, d'être membre de la police, Royal Mounted Police, mais ça durait jusqu'à l'âge de 15 ans. En tout cas, j'ai toujours une énorme admiration pour ce pays, pour la nature, pour la culture et tout ce qu'on respire ici. Oh, I just changed. I'm going to say a few words. I beg you to forgive me if I do not stand up all the time, because I want to take advantage of this microphone. I'm in the tail of, of une allergie au platane oriental. We're in spring time in Chile, where we were, my wife and I, 4 days ago, and I have had one of the worst hay fevers I've ever had. So I could be without voice very easily. Well, I'll tell you about what happened in Chile, very summarily, because you must be very aware of our dictatorship. We had elected a president, Salvador Allende, who obtained 30% of the votes. Is it in English or in French that I have to speak here?
It's a typical Montreal question.
Yes.
Yes. English is fine. We'll keep going in English.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm very absent.
This is a bilingual faculty within an Anglophone university, within a multilingual city, within a bilingual country. So basically, any of the three will be.
Okay. Thank you. Well, Salvador Allende was socialist and he got elected. And naturally that caused a great pain to President Nixon, to the United States government, to the CIA, etc. And briefly, a coup took place in Chile 3 years after Salvador Allende had been elected. The reasons for that coup, for the coup d'etat, were mainly to get Allende out of power. He was considered to be socialist, therefore he was socialist, therefore he was a threat for democracy. Secondly, the coup had to get rid of communism and all the allies, Mirismo, Socialismo, many, many ismas that were the enemies of the country. Thirdly, there had to be order again, because during three years of Allende, there had been lots of sabotage in our industry, in our commerce, and the people did not have the necessary things to live with. And then there was also lots of chaos, social, economic, cultural chaos. The people were kind of afraid to lose the objects in their lives that have given them happiness. And finally, the country had to have a new form of economy. It was a democratic social system, or a social democratic system. And we had had that system during many years. We had a constitution in 1925 that gave the form of our institutions that of a country that had to have a big state of welfare and, at the same time, private initiatives. The thing was that it was a social democrat country, like the social democratic countries of Europe. That was our way of seeing things. We had a model that was France, and everybody seemed to be rather happy with that system. But with the coup, we pretended to have a neoliberal or neo-capitalistic system, and a very harsh one, where the state is like that, perhaps for police, for the justice, for the soldiers, and then all the rest, the great quantity of initiative, would be private. Well, the coup d'etat was produced the 11th of September 1973, and Allende died at the presidential palace. Many people thought that he was killed. Lately, there have been expertise where it is known that he shot himself. He didn't want to go out of the palace, having been chosen by the people and to go out by force. He thought that was not it did not dignify the presidency of a country. I'll speak about the hard facts of the dictatorship, and then I think we could open the conversation with René. During the dictatorship, there were more than 3,100 people murdered, more than 1,200 people disappeared, more than 250,000 people were tortured, and besides that, all the persons that were shoved out of the country, taken from their works, and losing their properties, and hundreds of other forms of violations against human rights were produced. The dictatorship lasted 17 years. The first 5 years were the most difficult ones. They were very harsh. Assassinations, as I said, forced disappeared, torture. The rest of the time, after an amnesty decree law of 1978, were milder years. But that doesn't mean that the human rights were not violated, and that many of these situations continued to be produced. Naturally, less than before. During the first 5 years, the judiciary acted as, I would say, as the biggest collaborators of the dictatorship. There were more than 10,000 habeas corpus writs that were denied, and that permitted many of these outrageous conducts to be produced. This permitted the military to want to continue and to become even crueler in their performance. Besides these 10,000 habeas corpus writs that were rejected, justice was very superficial. Justice regarding the violations of human rights. Most of the cases were driven from the ordinary tribunals to the military tribunals, where also after a small period of very superficial investigations, all the cases finished with acquittals. After 1978, the judges simply applied the amnesty decree law, and like that, there was a total impunity of these sorts of crimes. After the dictatorship, justice was kind of reestablished, but it was not until 1998, when a criminal complaint was filed against Pinochet, that the judiciary started to be more concerned in the necessity of investigating these causes of human rights violations. Would this be sufficient? Yes, to start to speak about something with a base. Thank you very much, René.
I know you're interested in philosophy, and so I thought I would start with a question that is somewhat philosophical. Based on your experience, how much does Anna Arendt's suggestion of the banality of evil, remember, you know, she famously wrote about Eichmann in Jerusalem and how ordinary a person he was in fulfilling these horrible deeds. And I wonder whether this resonated in you, in your function as a judge dealing with some perpetrators who had done horrible deeds, and those who saw the movie, the judge and the general, saw in that movie at least one example of a truly disturbing individual. Did all of this seem banal to you in the sense that Anna Arendt understands that it is easy to fall into a pattern of brutality and denial of human rights?
Well, I realized that was easy for those people who were prepared to act within the worst evil that could exist. But I think that philosophy is good in and is necessary to be touched also in our Chilean military system. I don't want to offend anybody. I have many relatives that are soldiers, and I respect them because they have been good soldiers. I haven't had any notion that they have been mixed with human rights violations, at least the ones I know well. But I've spoken with many soldiers, and they have told me, why are you, sir, so surprised, Mr. Guzman? We are taught to kill, we have to kill, and we have to consider that we're killing for good reasons, for our nation, for our families, for the education of our kids. We don't want them to be communists. We want them to be Catholic or Christian. And, well, we are stopping evil to take the things that we want and that we need and that we have always had. That's what we are shooting for. That's why we are killing, and we were taught to kill. This is the most important thing. We have to do our work killing. Well, it's difficult to accept that view, that point of view. I never did. I always thought that this was a easy talk that had to do with why some people used a uniform. Answering your question, I think it's very easy. It's very easy to get involved in evil. Sometimes it's just beginning to do things that are disagreeable at the beginning, and that afterwards they convert, they are transformed to the day-to-day acting of the people. I visited a place where great quantity of people were tortured. It is called Via Grimaldi. It's about, I would say, like a block. It's a little bit bigger than a block of land. And there were hundreds of people imprisoned during the week, during the weekends also. And there were some swimming pools in Via Grimaldi. And Saturdays and Sundays, the soldiers that worked in Via Grimaldi, that tortured, that were the guards there, took their children to those swimming pools, and the children laughed, played, made all sorts of noises, and the prisoners heard the children, and in a way they thought that there was some hope that someday they would be freed from all that was happening with them and for against them. But looking at the things from the other side, the soldiers that took their children to have fun in the places where the worst things happened, that means that it wasn't evil for them, it was just their work. If they would have been lumberjacks, you say, they would have been in the place where they cut the trees, or if they would have been carpenters, they would have been in the places where they work with their carpentry. Yes, they were submitted, they were surrounded by evil so much that they couldn't realize that was really evil.
Yeah, there's perhaps a tendency when you work in human rights to think of situations in terms that are overly black and white, and to think of, you know, and we even speak in those terms, you know, this was a dark period for Chile, where as if everything was dark. But in fact, everything was probably pretty ordinary for most of the people most of the time in most respects. I lived in Buenos Aires near ESMA, the army, the Navy Mechanical School, where the biggest center for torture was based during the dictatorship. And this was I visited it on a special occasion, and the person was explaining that the stadium where the finals of the 1978 World Cup was played, the Estadio Monumental, is just two blocks away, and that the prisoners could hear the cheers of the crowds as Argentina was winning the World Cup, as they themselves were being tortured in the middle of the city on one of the major thoroughfares, ironically called Avenida del Libertador, but where you know, the sounds of torture didn't spill out into the street, but the sounds of the street certainly did penetrate into the torture rooms. And you know, making the point of ordinary life keeping going. And the point of the banality of evil is that there isn't a clear demarcation that tells someone, you know, whoops, you've stepped over the line and you're now on the dark side. Because for every genocide, generates its own justificatory narrative. And every dictatorship will provide a rationale that explains why it's important to kill Jews or educated people or communists or whoever is identified as needing to be getting rid of for the greater good. And then this brings me to the question of, next to the banality of evil, whether there is also the banality of good. In the sense that when we watch the movie, we get a sense that you are a lone ranger trying to bring justice in a very, very difficult situation. They make the point that you had to wear a bulletproof vest because there was very significant support for Pinochet in opposition to what you were trying to do, which begs the question then of how alone were you? How alone did you feel in attempting to unearth these crimes and bring some justice to the victims? Was good easy to find around you, or was it a lonely struggle?
Thank you very much. It's a question that I have to divide in two. My family gave me all the support that I could have. My wife, who's here present, she's a daughter. She doesn't like me to say that. She's a daughter of a hero from the resistance in France. He was, her father, André Watine, was during 4 or 5 years working underground. He took parachuters from the north of France and Belgium all the way down to the Pyrenees, to the mountains and to Spain. And in many occasions I spoke with him. He told me, "Vous savez, Juan, les années où j'étais dans la résistance étaient les meilleures années de ma vie." No, and I realized that it could be true, and in a way for me also it was true. The investigations I performed, the risks I took, pushed me very much more towards my family, towards Ines, my daughters, my mother. My mother, once I said, "Look, mother, I may be shot. I hope you kind of realize that it's necessary if it's necessary." And my mother surprised me. She said, "Look, I consider myself as the mother of the soldier. If something happens to you, I will accept it. I will be very sad, but I will try to live up to what has happened and live the best I can." Well, I got very surprised. I realized that she was 100 times braver than I. And finally, I was very... I felt the love from the people who were very near to me. Secondly, I worked with a group of 30 policemen from the civil Chilean police, that is not uniformed policemen, and they gave me all their loyalty, the secrecy we needed in order to investigate, and I felt very much attached to them, and we played as if we were kids. We were all the time fooling around, bullying, kind of telling jokes, inventing stupid games, sketches, and things like that. But this was because it was necessary. There were 2 or 3 days in all these investigations where we had to work in a cemetery. And we looked over hundreds of layers of bodies. It was what they called fosa común, common graves. And there we had to work with masks and with very little hope, because examining 1,500 bodies as we did, quickly with IRC experts and all that, it was really difficult to think that we were going to find anything. We had to try to find the remains that were interesting for the families that were giving us the information where the bodies of their people could be. Well, with the with the not soldiers, with the policemen, I felt very accompanied. I kind of woke up every morning thinking of the jokes, of the things we would be doing, and naturally thinking of the things we had to do in our work. I told you a few minutes ago the difficulties we had in having time to be able to perform the jobs we had to do. By the other hand, the rest of the society, of the Chilean society, save those who were relatives of the victims, showed me lots of disrespect, lots of, let's say, let me find the right word, desprecio, mépris, oui, contempt. And that was all the time, ladies that stopped me in the street and say, Monsieur Guzman, je vous dis une chose, je vous ai profondément. I hate you most deeply. And well, oh, at the beginning, that hurt me quite a lot. I was doing my job. I was trying to do it the best I could. And people simply said that they hated me because I was not in their trench, That was afterwards. I realized that the best thing I could do was do what my father did when he didn't like a person and he was scolded. My father was a poet, but poets could be also very violent, and sometimes there were poets that said that my father's work was insignificant. And then my father would say, you know, sir, you do not exist. Well, I started using the same the same words, and really that helped me quite a lot. Well, I did not have any support from the courts. The Supreme Court, neither the Court of Appeals, where I worked, and I would say that I must have had 10 judges that were with me, and the rest of the judges, I was the comunacho, Juan Guzman. Comunacho is like the coco. No, what is so pejorative word to say communist? Well, I was coco Guzman. Yes, and well, that I didn't care. I'm not a communist, but I have many friends that are communists and very good communists. So I didn't care much about that. Little by little, I started realizing that you don't need many people finally in your life to feel happy. I started to be and to feel happy with these people who gave me so much happiness. My wife, my daughters, my mother, a few friends, the policemen, and some judges.
Vous avez été nommé juge par le président Allende, pas nécessairement parce que vous étiez son allié politique, mais par un concours de circonstances, disons. Mais suite à la fin prématurée et rapide du régime Allende, vous êtes devenu juge dans le régime Pinochet. Et donc, pendant des années, vous avez siégé comme juge dans ce système que vous avez vous-même décrit tout à l'heure. Bon, les plus grands collaborateurs, vous avez dit, étaient parmi la magistrature sous Allende. Et ça pose la question, bon, peut-être pas directement, mais ça évoque un débat célèbre qu'il y a eu en Afrique du Sud entre Raymond Watts et John Dugard au sujet des juges qui siégeaient au sein des tribunaux en Afrique du Sud, dont par exemple Richard Goldstone. Donc on sait qu'ils n'étaient pas tous racistes et qu'ils ne souscrivaient pas tous à l'idéologie du régime, mais néanmoins ils participaient à un système qui, pour des gens comme Raymond Watts, était des systèmes d'oppression. Et un individu ne peut rien faire s'il est dans le système que d'être lui-même un élément d'oppression. Et c'est pourquoi Watts disait, il a écrit un texte célèbre, « Should judges resign? » Et sa réponse à lui, c'était oui. Il faut, si on se trouve confronté à un tel système d'injustice, refuser d'y participer et se retirer du système. Je voulais vous poser la question, est-ce que vous, avant de commencer à travailler sur la caravane de la mort et puis ces affaires un peu qui s'alignaient avec peut-être vos convictions, est-ce que vous avez été confronté comme juge au système de répression et puis à la nécessité de faire partie de ce système? Et entre Watts et Dugard, est-ce que vous êtes d'accord avec Richard Goldstone qu'il vaut mieux un allié dans le système pour assouplir le système de l'intérieur plutôt que de souhaiter que tous ceux qui sont plus raisonnables quittent la magistrature pour ne laisser que des radicaux qui vont appliquer la loi avec toute la brutalité qui est possible et résulter en moins de justice finalement sous la dictature?
Vous savez, René, c'est la première fois qu'on me demande ça. Et je pense qu'on doit être honnête, toujours. Même si l'honnêteté peut jouer contre toi. Et pendant que vous développez votre question, j'essayais de penser aux choses où j'aurais pu être contraint à faire ce que je ne voulais pas faire et continuer dans ma siège. Et oui, j'avais jamais pensé que j'allais être confronté à la sincérité dans une situation pareille. J'étais membre, j'étais président d'un tribunal dans la ville de Panguipulli, petite ville au sud du Chili, qui s'appelle Panguipulli, ça veut dire terre des lions en Mapudungun, la langue mapuche du Chili. Et quelques jours après le coup, il y a eu beaucoup de lois qui ont été dictées, mais finalement, pour la première fois, je suis devenu juge d'un tribunal collégié, où il y avait trois juges, et un juge, c'était moi, j'étais le président de ce tribunal. Il y avait un autre membre qui appartenait au ministère du Travail. Mais je me rappelle quel était le poste, inspecteur, je pense, disons inspecteur d'un tribunal du ministère du Travail. Et l'autre était le maire, pardon, El prefecto. Le préfet, c'était un carabinero, c'était un police uniformé. On devait analyser des situations des gens qui avaient été mis à la porte. I'm sorry, I always changed without realizing. We had to analyze people who had been fired from their jobs because they had done things that were improper. And most of these people were accused of putting bombs, of trying to create sabotage in the fisheries, in the places where fish are
factories
of fish, well, where the fish are really, where they are swimming and they go from one exclusa to the other, you know? Fish farms, yes. People who work in fish farms that had been fired. It had to do with the tribunal of appeals produced by the working people who were fired. There, I was the judge, one of the three judges, and all the cases, I don't remember of one where we did accept the petition. All these people were maintained fired, and what was proved to us that these people were dangerous for society, for the fisheries, for so and so and so. And I didn't even think in a moment that this was just a nettoyage d'image. How could you say that?
I think everybody gets
it. Okay. Yes, I would say yes. That was the first and I believe the only time that I had problems with my own conscience. I think I played the game. And I'm very sorry of having played the game. Perhaps if I would have been stronger in my knowledge and how do you say a person who acts according to what he thinks? What? Yes.
Conscience.
Yes, I think that's a very big lack I had that lasted about 2 months. It didn't bother me very much, but today it does bother me. It bothers me and makes me think that I was not keen enough to do what I had to do. That's afterwards, I have been confronted to situations where, as a member of a court of appeals, studying habeas corpus writs that were presented by students that were imprisoned. In that occasion, I was in the Court of Appeals of Talca. Talca is a town 255 kilometers south of Santiago. There I was appointed as a member of the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals are the tribunals that receive the habeas corpus writs. And there I was very much aware what happened to the students. I know that they were tortured. I know that they were taken to prisons where they were taken there to be tortured. In that occasion, I was the only vote between three. Our chambers are formed by three members, and I was the only vote that stood for accepting the habeas corpus writs, because that was what I had to do. That was my conscience, and but I knew also what was happening in that part. That was 1989. 1983, 1984, 1988. I'm very happy of that part, though.
¿Existe aún un riesgo de regreso a situaciones de violación de derechos humanos como esas? ¿O son estas historias del pasado y se puede decir ahora que existe una cultura de derechos humanos que hace lo imposible de ver una dictadura que hace cosas similares, a pesar de lo que podemos ver en lugares como Venezuela, donde claro que hay presiones hasta la negación de derechos humanos, pero quizás gente como jueces ahora crecieron con una cultura de derechos humanos, entonces no es lo mismo que vos hace muchos años cuando era un poco más... los derechos humanos fueron más afuera de la realidad de los jueces.
Unfortunately, I think that it's very easy, speaking of Anaras, you put the subject, the topic, at the beginning, and I think we continue to be in the same topic. Unfortunately, I think it's very easy to go back to irregular situation of where crimes or violations of human rights are committed. Actually, in Chile and in many countries of the world, these violations are produced every day, every minute in the prisons. The prisoners are shoved, hit. We have pictures where we see the violations they have been submitted to. And we see that also when there is a riot, when the students are protesting against the system. We see how the police is working. We see that's very easy for the people who maintain order to not be violent. We see that all the time, more than before, because everything is showed due to the to the television and to all the new systems, technical systems. By the other hand, we look around what's happening in the world, in Syria, in Iraq, in Russia, all over, and it's so easy to come to go back to something. I'm, in a way, I'm very much scared that even in countries like us, like ours, we could go back to a system that could not be very a very happy one. Now we are happy that the U.S. government is more aware of human rights, but 40 years ago, the U.S. government helped us to make the coup, to torture. They took our soldiers to Panama and other places where they were taught how to torture. And I think it's very easy to get a system that could make us change, unfortunately.
Hello, and I'd like to thank you for being so open about your experiences, even the difficult questions. In the documentary that we saw, at one point you talk about how the eyes of your soul were opened. And I was wondering if you could take us back to the moment where you felt that beginning to happen and talk about what exactly that was like, what exactly happened that changed you.
Thank you. It's a difficult question to answer, but with images, it's perhaps easier. And the image that I have in front of me is like a glass of water. Many times we say that the last drop overflows. No, that's a bit what happened to me. I received all sorts of declarations. Example, a doctor, a psychiatrist, told me, look, Mr. Guzman, I don't want to speak about the time I was in prison because I had a very, very bad time. I said, well, doctor, you are collaborating towards the silence, and it's precisely the silence what makes things worst in this moment. We need to have information. I have to know what happened. I have to know what happened to you, because what happened to you must have happened to other victims also. And then, that doctor said, look, Mr. Guzman, it's so terrible what happened to me that I cannot say it. Well, and then I started, I have had experience in interrogating people. I had to know how to get to make him declare, even if he didn't want to. It was history. It was history that was necessary to give us all the versions of what happened. And he said, finally, in two words, it's not agreeable to speak about, he said, look, I was once hanged and with my legs open, and somebody shoved a gun in my anus, and I had all my, sphincters torn with the part of the gun that with part of the gun,
yeah.
No, and you know the part where you aim. And in French, the mire, yes. Well, and then he told me that, and he started to cry like a baby. I took him to the bathroom. He washed his face and continued to cry. And today we're good friends, and he always tells me, "Look, Juan, thank you for insisting for me to tell you, because I hadn't even told my wife about this, and this today I realized that hurt me very much." Well, that story, another story, a story of a woman that was raped, a story of another woman that was raped, a story of a person that was taken from one place to the other in the floor without clothing, and that they were bleeding all over their face, their elbows, their shoulders. And then you hear, up to a moment where the water gets up to the upper part of the glass and it overflows. The same thing happened to me in the sense of hearing so many things from the suffering people. These people all had suffered terribly, and their relatives suffered worstly, because the relatives of the disappeared continue to suffer up to the date, and hearing their experiences, hearing the last time they spoke with their son or their sister. Well, one day I simply felt that I started to look at the world curiously from my heart. That's what perhaps I don't say it well in the picture. I say, I think I say, as you said, of the eyes of my soul. Perhaps I meant the eyes of my heart.
Bueno, yo en primer lugar le quería agradecer la conferencia, ha sido realmente interesante. Y lo que me gustaría plantearle es cuál es la postura del gobierno chileno en la actualidad respecto a la recuperación histórica y a la memoria histórica de las víctimas. And so my question is, what's the position from the government from Chile towards the victims nowadays in that moment? Gracias.
Thank you. Well, it's the vision this is a response that is going to be a little bit ambiguous. I'm going to say about how things should be and how things are. When I indicted Pinochet for the first time, that is in 2000, I received a telephone call. I don't know whether this is said in the picture. I received a telephone call from the ministry, from the Secretary of Justice, to overrule my own decision and say that Pinochet was okay, that he was not a culprit, that he was not declared as the author of a group of crimes that he had committed. Well, first of all, my wife was with me. We were right next to the telephone, and she heard me, what I said. And I really got annoyed and said, look, you do not have the right to telephone me and to ask me something that is really an insolence. It's an insolence to justice, and it's an insolence to the people. So then I hanged the telephone. That same, the president that was president at that moment, Mr. Lagos, he said the same day when they asked him, what do you think of having Pinochet accused today as it has happened. And President Lagos said, that means that the institutions are working. That's what was said to the people. What are the different governments doing regarding the historical recuperation of the victims? I think that the governments are doing a good job. I think that there is a museum, a very important museum, a very good museum of human rights in Santiago. There are many memorials all over the country. That is a little bit sad because the people in Chile are not very careful. They don't maintain the installations well. The places are sometimes full of dirt, full of... They're not well. They're sad memorials to see, and they're not kept by the institutions nor by the people. They're full of paint, of graffiti also. That is very shameful. But in general, I would say that the historical recuperation of the victims has been a priority in most of the governments. I would say that even in the right-wing government of Mr. Piñera, I would say that he also did the same job in conserving the history of the victims.
Your Honor, thank you very much for your presence here today. It's really a privilege to hear you speak, and an even greater privilege to be in the room with the daughter of a member of the Resistance. I heard from my stepfather of his journey across France, having landed at Normandy, being wounded in the hedgerows. Heard stories about meeting the Resistance, and even though it's one generation removed, for a son of an American soldier, it's really an honor and a privilege. My question goes to the state of information that the world had or didn't have at the time of the torture, the atrocities against human rights. At that time, were any mass media or mass communications or newspaper reporters in any country trying to get the word out? And if so, was there one or more countries leading the way? Today we take information fluidity for granted. It wasn't that way back at the time, but was there word getting out? And again, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you very much. Is the question concretely, was there journalists and photographs taken? Would that be the
if I picked up the New York Times.
Yes. I don't think so. I don't think so. But I want to be very exact, because it's very important what you're saying. We realize that there are human rights violations, because we see them in a screen today. At that time, we didn't see them, and we didn't believe they happened. Would you get annoyed, Ines, with me if you told the audience what you thought and what you were told by the French people that happened in Chile? Est-ce que tu peux parler en français, naturellement, au sujet de ce que tu voyais, tu pensais, et ce que pensaient tes amis vis-à-vis les atrocités qui se passer au Chili. Tu veux le truc?
Je ne sais pas ce que je viens faire ici avec le micro. Parce que, bon, quand j'étais étudiante, j'étais bien idéaliste. Je rêvais d'un monde meilleur pour le continent sud-américain, surtout à partir de 59-60. Donc, à l'université, mes amis étaient très souvent des mêmes tendances, un peu extrémistes que moi, à la grande tristesse de mes parents. Et bien sûr, après le coup d'État, au début du coup d'État, on me demandait s'il y avait encore des corps qui flottaient sur le Mapocho, si j'en avais vu beaucoup, etc., si vraiment la vie était supportable, s'il y avait des excès. Et nous, ma foi, qui étions en province, on travaillait beaucoup toute la journée, on savait qu'il y avait eu des excès, mais moi je leur disais, écoute, viens au Chili, on te montrera. Je crois que c'est de la propagande communiste. Je crois que le Chili, malheureusement, Allende a été ce qui nous a le plus fait mal pour jour du coup d'État, c'est qu'Allende soit mort, parce qu'il était quand même plein de très bonnes intentions. Mais le Chili est un pays calme. Ça, c'était dans les années...
C'est ça ce que tu voulais que je dise?
Ben oui. Bon, eh bien je le regrette. Mais aussi, je voudrais profiter de cette interruption que je fais en ce moment pour vous dire que notre prise de conscience s'est faite extrêmement graduellement grâce à ce que Juan découvrait un peu à la fois dans les cours lorsqu'il était à la cour d'appel à Talca, près de Santiago, et ensuite à Santiago, et que nos yeux se sont ouverts à ce moment-là. Alors j'ai bien sûr communiqué à tous mes amis que dans le fond ils avaient bien raison et que j'étais désolée de m'être trompée dans les années 82-83, hein. Et qu'à partir de là, dans le fond, le travail de mon mari a été un peu ingrat, parce que il y a une forte hiérarchie dans l'armée, et si les subalternes racontaient ce qu'ils avaient fait aux victimes, eh bien, pour mon mari, ce n'était pas pour les inculper eux, mais son but à lui, ça a toujours été d'arriver à la tête de la hiérarchie militaire, c'est-à-dire à Pinochet, qui se plaisait à déclarer que rien dans le pays ne s'était passé sans qu'il le sache, même pas le mouvement d'une feuille à l'automne s'il y a un peu de vent. Alors ça, dans le fond, toutes ces années d'enquête, de recherche, de disparus, retrouver des petits morceaux d'eau, essayer de voir si l'ADN marche, tout cela, dans le fond, dans l'esprit de Juan. Bien sûr, il y a 800 militaires inculpés qui ont fait de la prison, qui sont encore en prison, mais ils voulaient arriver à Pinochet. Voilà. Je ne sais pas si j'ai répondu à ce que tu voulais que je dise. Bien. Oui. Oui.
Tu fais mille fois mieux que moi.
Pues, juez Guzmán, señora, muchas gracias por su presentación. Je vais formuler ma question en français, justement très liée avec votre intervention. Je me suis demandé, en regardant le documentaire, comment vous vous sentiez quand Pinochet vous filait entre les doigts, d'une certaine façon. Donc, on a vu, par exemple, quand Pinochet a été détenu en Angleterre sous un mandat d'arrestation espagnol, on se demandait si elle était extradée, ça a duré plusieurs mois. Comment vous êtes senti à ce moment-là? Est-ce que vous vouliez que Pinochet soit jugé pour les assassinats d'Espagnols en Espagne, ou vous souhaitiez qu'au final, il puisse revenir au Chili pour que vous poursuiviez vos enquêtes? Et dans un deuxième temps, comment est-ce que vous êtes senti à la mort de Pinochet, quand finalement il vous a vraiment filé entre les doigts? Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Vous savez, ne vous fâchez pas, si je suis très amical dans la façon dont je vais vous répondre, mais... Il y a la loi de mineur effort, de moindre effort, la loi de moindre effort, the law of the least effort. Donc, c'est très humain. Quand Pinochet est tombé dans les mains des garçons, moi j'ai sauté de joie. Non. Oui, j'ai dit, quel problème de moins. Non. Quand Pinochet était... quand il a pu sortir de la prison en Angleterre et qu'il venait dans l'avion au Chili, je ne veux pas dire le mot que je dis, mais c'était sûrement en faisant comme ça, très... Non. Et finalement, il retourne à moi. Non, on est des êtres humains. On n'est pas des justiciers. Et oui, j'étais très déçu. J'étais très déçu par la justice, de la justice chilienne, quand la justice chilienne a laissé tout sans effet. Quand Pinochet avait été inculpé dans une affaire qui était horrible, qui s'appelait la caravane de la mort. C'était la mort, l'assassinat de plus de 75 personnes qui étaient dans des cachots militaires. Et après opération Condor, c'était l'assassinat dans toute l'Amérique latine, même aux États-Unis et en Italie, où ils ont opéré la DINA, c'est-à-dire l'intelligence, le bureau d'intelligence de l'armée. Bon, non, là je me suis fâché, je dis, on fait un travail de bijouterie, parce que c'était un travail de bijouterie d'incriminer Pinochet. Et finalement, tout ça, c'était des faits. Ça m'a fait assez mal. Et ça, je ne veux pas dire certains mots, mais là, j'ai senti du mépris pour la Cour suprême.
Hola, Juan. Buenas tardes. Hi, my name is Pablo. I'm from Chile, grad student at McGill. Well, I have a chance to see the documentary, and well, firstly, congratulations for all your work. I think your documentaries well describe all your diligent
could
jobs.
Could you speak a little bit
slower?
Stronger, please.
Stronger, yeah. Yes. No, well, I have a... thank you, that's better. I have a questions. In the documentary also, I think it says that you have a few chances to interrogate Pinochet face to face. I was wondering what was your feeling about him, about if he was a friendly person, he was confident of his thoughts, about his answers. And secondly, I would like to ask you, although Pinochet on that time was very delicate health, if he could have been sent to jail, what do you think would happen? He would have been sent to these special facilities for former army persons, such as Punta Peuco, and in terms of the impact in the Chilean justice system, political system, and in the society in general. Thank you.
Thank you. What's your name?
Paolo.
Paolo. Well, this experience, the Pinochet experience for me, made me become very realistic in the sense that I only thought of this case and of what could happen today and not tomorrow, nor take my worries to my sleep during the night. I learned many things during those 8 years that I was investigating the human the violations against human rights. The tête-à-tête with Pinochet, I had two reunions with him in order to have him give a declaration. The first time was in 2001, simply 2000, the year 2000, where he was what I had seen in the television and what I had seen before. He was a normal man, 80-something years old, very healthy looking, with a very nice aspect, and lots of jokes. So, Mr. Guzman, how does this weather treat you, and things like that, and would you permit me to go to the north of Chile, because there I really love that part of the country, and I think that you do not have the need of my person too much here in Santiago, do you? And he was a very kind of witty, cunning person, and that we had always seen in TV and in his conversations with other people. He had lots of, he didn't say brilliant things, but he said them. He said just anything. And when he spoke, nobody else spoke because nobody dared to speak. But, well, he was very willing to say anything. And I said, look, General, did you order the killing of 75 persons in Caravan of Death? Oh, no, I have never ordered the killing of any person. I have never touched a person. I have never done anything to any person. So, this was the way he answered to me, very, very like, as a matter of fact. He even offered me coffee, and his wife came into the room where we were, the living room. She sat down, and we had a little bit of coffee, and we spoke about anything. I don't even remember what we spoke about, but we spoke about just anything. At the end of that conversation, I had a problem. The computer that we were working with got out of order, and that made me speak about an hour more with Pinochet, or that made me hear him an hour more. And when I received the affidavit, the document with his declaration, I read it to see if it was according to what he had told me before. And as I saw, I didn't find any mistake. I said, General, you can read it. And he said, no, caballero chileno, no, Chilean gentleman. No, I won't read it. I don't need to read it. Well, the lawyers were there. and they did read every word. But once he signed it, he passed it to me and shaked hands, and that was the end of the conversation. Well, that was in 2000, and that was for the issue Caravan of Death. But in 2004, for the episode called Operación Cóndor, that where there were hundreds of people killed and hundreds of people disappeared, he was very fat, very bad looking. His face was round. He was, how do you say, bloodshot? Bloodshot. And he weighed something like 130 kilos. No, it was incredible. From 80 to 130, he was another man. And there he was very, very disagreeable with me. And at the end, when I gave him the sheet of paper that contained his declaration, he said, I need my lawyers, because this guy, he pointed to me, this guy writes things that I've never said. So that was how he acted with me. And naturally, I shook hands with him, but he looked very reluctant as to shake hands with me. And that made me think that he was not perhaps competent mentally. In the first occasion, I found him very well. I found him absolutely competent and much more intelligent than my own person. In the second occasion, I had so many doubts that I, in the picture, I don't know whether you saw that picture, the general and the judge. In that picture I speak, it's a documentary. Yeah. There I speak about the doubts I had.
Yes.
And finally, it was one thing that made me realize that he was competent, and it was an interview that I was able to see on the TV that was done by a journalist from Cuba, from Miami, but originally from Cuba.
He was very clear answering and chatting with
him. He was very clear, and he spoke about something like 11 or 12 different issues, very bright-minded. I don't know whether I've answered your question well.
It's
according to... Okay.
So we've come to the end of our time, so it leads me to invite you to join me in saying congratulations and thank you to Judge Guzman, not only for talking to us today, but also for all the work that he's done over many, many years to bring some justice to the victims of oppression in Chile. Thank you very much.
Now? Yeah, in here. Oh.